It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's become a common belief in the U.S. that education would be the great equalizer in our society. But the Wisconsin author of a new book says it hasn't worked out that way and makes the case that education should be seen as a pillar of democracy rather than a ticket to economic mobility. Now, last night was the first Republican presidential debate leading up to the 2024 election. There were eight candidates on the Milwaukee stage: former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, former Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson, North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, former Vice President Mike Pence, entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy, and Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina. One candidate conspicuously missing: frontrunner Donald Trump. The candidates talked about abortion, climate change, immigration, Ukraine, and more. We're talking about the first Republican debate. It took place at the Fiserv Forum in Milwaukee last night. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you watched the primary debate last night, what'd you think? What's your reaction? What issues or answers stuck out to you? Was there a candidate you didn't know much about that now you want to learn more about? If you're likely to vote Republican in the 2024 election, do any of the candidates who aren't Donald Trump appeal to you? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Susan Johnson is an associate professor of political science and associate dean in the College of Letters and Sciences at UW-Whitewater. Susan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Before we dig into the content of the debate last night and the candidates, I always kind of wonder, you know, we have these debates in my mind, in theory, so that voters can learn about the candidates, their policies, their temperaments, their abilities. Did the debate accomplish that civic function in your mind?
I think so. I mean, I think that whenever you have a situation where you've got several people on the stage who are all vying for the same prize, so to speak, that you get to do a bit of a compare and contrast. And I think that that last night served that purpose.
We've got a front runner in pretty much all the polls, former President Trump, not there at the debate. What did you make of that? Did you see this as a good opportunity for some of the rest of the field to stand out there?
Absolutely. I think that Trump, former President Trump, deciding to not attend meant that his presence was not there, and therefore other people would have the opportunity to try to get more of the spotlight and the attention. And I think that the people who were participating, he came up quite a bit. I heard that he was like the third biggest topic, if you want to talk about topics, as far as mentions and things like that. But as I was watching it over the course of 2 hours, I didn't necessarily, he didn't seem to be looming large, I should say.
There was a direct question about Trump, whether the candidates would support him if he were convicted on some of the charges and still was a Republican candidate. Six out of the eight raised their hands to Chris Christie, and Asa Hutchinson said they wouldn't. Here's some of what Chris Christie had to say.
Donald Trump said it's okay to suspend the Constitution. Now, the oath you take is to preserve, protect, and defend, not suspend. I will always stand up for our Constitution, regardless of the political pressure.
Chris Christie taking a lane, as people say, being willing to openly criticize the president. A lot of the candidates kind of dancing a finer line. Obviously, they want to make the case better them than Donald Trump, but not necessarily willing to take him on head on. What did you hear?
Depending on who of the eight we're referring to, I think it ran the gamut. You had some who were eager to raise their hand and line up in lockstep with former President Trump. And then you had others, as you mentioned, like Chris Christie, Asa Hutchinson. I think Nikki Haley is another one who I think was trying to position herself as the alternative to Trump in many ways, even though she said she would support him if he were the nominee. I think that for most of the people on the stage, it was an easy hand raise. And I say that in the sense that they signed a pledge to the RNC that they would support the nominee. And then also thinking about it from the perspective of the audience, many people in the audience were strong Trump supporters. And so to raise your hand in that audience was more times than not going to be received favorably.
Let's look into some of the issues that came up. Abortion was a big issue. Some candidates, including former Vice President Pence, favored a federal abortion ban, talking about a 15-week limit. Here's former U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley setting out her piece on the issue.
We need to stop demonizing this issue. This is talking about the fact that unelected justices didn't need to decide something this personal, because it's personal for every woman and man. Now it's been put in the hands of the people. That's great. When it comes to a federal ban, let's be honest with the American people and say it will take 60 Senate votes. It will take a majority of the House. So in order to do that, let's find consensus.
What did you make of how the candidates handled the issue of abortion last night, Susan?
Really liked her response, particularly the latter part. As I was sitting there watching the debate so many times, as different candidates were promising to do X, Y, or Z, my response was, well, you can't do that. And I mean that because, as she was speaking, you need 60 votes in the Senate, or you just can't eliminate federal agencies, as many of them promised to do. There was a lot of on day one, I will do this, and candidates do this. Barack Obama promised to shut down Guantanamo on day one, and that still exists. So I really appreciated her saying, we will not be able to necessarily do a national ban. I also think that it was a way for her to answer the question without answering the question.
Talking to Susan Johnson from UW-Whitewater, looking at last night's Republican primary presidential debate in Milwaukee. Eight candidates who met the criteria for polling and fundraising. And one candidate not there, of course, former President Donald Trump. You can join in with your reactions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on Joe in Milwaukee. Joe, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to make the observation that Donald Trump suggested that he didn't attend because it served his purposes, but I would argue that he absolutely couldn't attend because very reasonable questions offered to him by the moderator or by the other candidates could end up further incriminating himself in one of the 90 charges against him or violating the terms of his bond for the four different cases that he's being charged for.
Joe, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. And now, Susan, former President Trump did a recorded interview with Tucker Carlson that was broadcast on the former Twitter X against this debate. What do you think of Joe's theory that the former president was avoiding potentially incriminating himself in a lively debate?
This would be the first time, I think. No, but in all seriousness, potentially his attorneys might have recommended against participating because he speaks openly, and so we've seen him run into situations already where judges and attorneys have told him to stop talking, basically. I think that there's also, however, political reasons for not participating, and when you're the front runner, as he is, it is not uncommon to not participate because you don't see anything to gain by participating. So I think Joe might be onto something.
Joe, thanks for the call. We'll go to Artis now in Delafield. Artis, hi.
Oops. Hi, can you hear me?
Yep, loud and clear. What did you want to bring up?
I can tell you that I found Ramaswamy absolutely just repulsive. He was completely disrespectful to everybody. And that being said, and I'm not a Republican, but that being said, I felt that Nikki Haley, especially in her response to abortion, I felt it was the most, it was also very pragmatic, but also somewhat, kind of empathic, knowing that this isn't, stop demonizing it, which I think is something that has been done.
Artis, thanks for the call. Vivek Ramaswamy stood out a lot for a lot of people, for better or worse, Susan, in the debate. Obviously a candidate people don't know a whole ton about, not a household name in the political world. A lot of people spending time analyzing his performance, in the debate last night. What did you think?
All the candidates, he was the one who's polling the highest. and who has the least amount of knowledge, information out there. So, I mean, I would say that you had the governor of North Dakota, who is probably the least known candidate on the stage, and many of the others are not well known as well. But you have someone, Ramaswamy, who is admittedly and proudly not a politician, and he's doing fairly well in the polls. And he had a lot to gain by coming out very forcefully and showing himself as being quite aligned with former President Trump on a majority of the issues, and trying to follow into that lane of being not a politician, but a businessman. And so I think that he tried to grab as much attention as he could. And you're absolutely right that he's the one who I think has generated the most, the responses that have been at one end of the spectrum or the other in terms of people's reaction to him.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to UW-Whitewater political scientist Susan Johnson about the first Republican presidential debate last night in Milwaukee. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you watch the debate last night? What were your takeaways? Did you happen to attend it? Love to hear from you if you were there in person. What did you want to hear more or less about? What did you like? What any particular candidate said about any particular issue? Join in now at 800-642-1234. Do you wish former President Trump, leading in the Republican primary polls, had attended? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater, about the first Republican presidential debate last night in Milwaukee. You could join in with your reactions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Susan, before I go back to our callers, one issue that I think has divided Republicans at the highest levels, support from Ukraine in its resistance to the Russian invasion. Vivek Ramaswamy in particular expressed the view that the U.S. should be less involved or maybe even not involved at all. Here's a listen.
I find it offensive that we have professional politicians on the stage that will make a pilgrimage to Kyiv, to their Pope, Zelensky, without doing the same thing for people in Maui or the south side of Chicago Kensington. I think that we have to put the interests of Americans first.
Got a strong response from some of the other Republicans on the stage. Ukraine is definitely an issue, I think, Susan, that there's not a Republican consensus on.
Well, Rob, there's not a consensus in that regard. And when the war started, I think there was more of a consensus. And now what we're seeing is more and more issues rising in regard to the cost and how much of our defense budget is being spent in Ukraine. Nikki Haley pointed out in response to some of those comments, she had her facts as far as that goes, and one would expect that she would. She also mentioned what this could mean for the rest of Europe should this happen. And I think that this is one of those issues. Whenever we get into foreign policy areas, there tends to be a considerable amount of support across the board early on. And then as things drag on, the support wanes, and that usually happens in both parties. But certainly, I think this is something that we're going to see more and more if it gets discussed in future debates and then in the campaign, where Republicans are going to be on differing sides.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Chris joins us now in Loyal. Chris, hi.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear. What did you want to bring up, Chris?
I've just been a lifelong Republican. Just looking over all of them, I don't really want to speak to Ukraine. Just none of these are serious people, and none of them have principle. I was raised to have principles, and I just couldn't be any more demoralized with, you know, the quality that we have here, especially the so-called front runner.
Chris, do you have names in mind? Are there candidates, individual people, or types of candidates you wish were stepping up in the race?
I suppose Pence comes the closest, but, you know, there's not a person that I haven't seen backtrack or change their mind or just, you know, I mean, the Ramaswamy was crazy, you know, every, and, you know, I look around at some of the people who say they represent what I represent, and they don't look anything like me, and they're booing things that don't make any sense to me.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. Susan, Chris, maybe part of a movement within the Republican Party, I think a smaller part, the so-called Never Trump movement. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but feeling disaffected with the Republican Party as it stands, even though they are lifelong Republicans. Do you think that's a significant block within potential Republican primary voters?
Now, when you look at the Republican Party electorate, people look at that solid core of people who are never going to support Trump. And then you have a solid core of people who are committed to him no matter what. And then Chris, you know, feels like he might be in that middle, but clear, but then leaning toward Never Trump, as you mentioned. And I think the issue is always for me, and I'm glad you asked him the question about who might you support otherwise, because then the question always for me thinking about it is, who is Chris going to vote for? Now, we don't really want to ask Chris that, but come the general election, for example, if Trump is the nominee, is he going to support Trump? Might he not vote? I mean, those are the questions that I wonder about when someone like Chris talks about dissatisfaction with the current slate of potential Republican Party nominees.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Jeff is with us now in Superior. Jeff, hey.
Hey, this is a great topic, of course, timely. I did listen to the debate, and I also listened to the interview with Tucker Carlson that Trump did. And if the election were today, I would vote for Trump. I would vote for him. I don't know how the rest of America feels, but a lot can happen between now and the convention or even Election Day. But if the election were today, I support Trump.
And Jeff, I got to ask, what would it take for another Republican primary contender to move up on the Jeff charts above Donald Trump?
Well, what I like about Trump, and I was a Democrat before I became a Republican, and so was Trump. I really want someone to renew our values as America, be constitutionally based, but also be as aggressive and have the perspective Trump has to see through the smokescreen of the socialists and those who are trying to destroy our country.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Sounds like Jeff's pretty solid on Trump all the way through the primaries, Susan. But something he said a lot can happen between now and the nomination process. This is still very early in the scope of things in a presidential race. A lot of things can and do change sometimes.
Absolutely. This is so early, and so much can happen, not just in thinking about the nomination, but also thinking about, you know, when we get to the general election. We're at the end of August, and the first contests begin in early 2024. There's a whole lot that can happen between then and now. We can just go through the litany of people who were front runners in August of the election year who never got close to the nomination. Now, I don't think that that's going to be the case with Trump, in the sense that he's really looking like the strong front runner, but, you know, things can happen with the different legal struggles that are going on, although nothing's going to come to conclusion between now and the contest starting. But yeah, it's way too soon to be making firm calls on things.
Thanks for the call, Jeff, at 800-642-1234. Looking at last night's Republican presidential debate, Susan Johnson is with us from UW-Whitewater. Susan, what else stood out to you as you were watching this debate that I haven't asked you about so far?
You know, a couple things I would say. The tenor on the stage and in the audience, it was not as, I think, as raucous as other debates have been. But clearly, in my mind, the moderators didn't have full control of the participants.
Yeah.
And they allowed them to talk over each other. The participants didn't seem to be respecting the time limits and things like that. So I think the moderators could have probably had a little bit more control. I was also interested in some of the topics that were covered. So they spent a lot of time talking about the southern border and the drug crisis and drugs coming over. And I mean, I suppose that's an issue that gets a lot of attention on Fox, and that's an issue that gets a lot of attention from Republican voters. So, but that was something that I think was a little bit of a lot of time was spent on those issues.
And finally, got to ask about the Wisconsin factor here. Wisconsin is a later state in the primary process, but a key state in the general election process. Republicans putting a lot of attention here, this debate, their convention. Could you talk about Republicans doing a lot of work here in the state?
Yeah, and I mean, Wisconsin was very close, as we know, and it has been very close in the last several presidential elections. And so I think we're going to be seeing a lot of people spending a lot of time here. I don't know that it's going to have a big impact on the primary, but they're not thinking about the primary. They're thinking about the general election in November.
As we wrap up, Susan, what are you watching for to see if this debate has an impact on voters over the next few months?
Well, I mean, I'm going to look at some of the polling numbers to see. I'm expecting a bounce for some people. And so I want to see if that's persistent or not. I'm also thinking about the next debates and whether former President Trump is going to continue to decline to participate or not.
Susan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Always happy to join you.
That's Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science and Associate Dean in the College of Letters and Sciences at the University of Wisconsin, Whitewater. She talked to us about last night's Republican presidential debate in Milwaukee, the first of the 2024 election cycle. You can keep following election news over at WPR.org, coverage here in the state, and from our national colleagues at NPR. Listen live to these conversations, catch up on the latest news stories, and stream live or archive. Or you can download the Wisconsin Public Radio app to your phone or tablet. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, a lot of kids get expelled from their preschool. Find out why that happens and what happens to things like their childcare situation and their early education when they do get expelled. If you have a story to share, maybe in your own family or if you work with a childcare provider, love to hear your perspective on this issue. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Then join the conversation tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, more reaction to last night's Republican presidential debate here in Wisconsin. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, many people were raised on the idea that getting a good college education would bring job security and upward economic mobility. And for some people, it does work out that way. But our next guest says there's a wider argument that education is the solution to economic inequality, and that's driven a lot of government policy. But he says things don't really work out that way, and that we've fallen prey to what he calls the education myth. And the myth isn't new. The idea that education can or even should be a one-way ticket to economic security and prosperity has been building, he writes, since the 1960s with support from both major political parties. He says the myth has done a lot of damage to people with college degrees who increasingly struggle with high debt and tough job markets, and to people without college degrees who often get left behind. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on the importance of education? What role do you think it should play in society? As a government policy, do you think that investing in education is the best way to deal with things like economic inequality? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. John Shelton is a professor and chair of Democracy and Justice Studies at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, and vice president for higher education for the American Federation of Teachers, Wisconsin. His new book is called The Education Myth, How Human Capital Trumped Social Democracy, and we're talking about that book right now. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here, and I hope folks are staying cool out there.
Definitely. Now, you're clear in the book. You like education. You're a college professor. You are for it in many ways. But as a social policy, a public policy, talk about the rise of this education myth that you're worried about.
Yeah. I mean, I'm an educator professionally, as you mentioned. So it'd be pretty weird if I thought education was a bad thing. Education is a great thing, right? It opens doors for people. It's central in how we conceptualize democracy and has been in this nation since, you know, really pretty close to the nation's founding. The problem is that the way Americans have thought about education has changed. And as you noted, this started to change in the 1960s, particularly in the Johnson administration, when policymakers started by Democrats, actually, right? Johnson was a Democrat. Drew on these ideas from a couple of from a school of economists called Human Capital. And the idea there was that investing in individual skills was the primary way that working people actually, first of all, was why the economy had been prosperous, and how it was that working people should seek economic prosperity, right? And it ignored a lot of the realities for why American workers were so much more prosperous in the 50s and 60s, things like labor unions and progressive taxation and the legacy of the New Deal. But this education myth really took root starting in the 1960s, and more Democrats believed in it, like Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton, all the way up through Barack Obama, and even to a certain extent, Joe Biden. And Republicans like George H.W. Bush, who said he wanted to be the education president, and of course, through No Child Left Behind under his son, there was a big political consensus that we don't need these other social interventions because they undercut the power of the wealthy, undercut the power of corporations, and make donors unhappy. And so all that was needed was to make it easier for workers to invest in their own education. And if they did that, they would be successful. And unfortunately, that ignores all of the things that actually happen in the labor markets, right? It's not just about a worker's individual skills. It's about whether the interest rates are high or not, right? And the Federal Reserve is trying to, lower economic productivity in order to reduce inflation. It's about where jobs are. Are there jobs in the city where you live? Doesn't matter what kind of education you have. If you're living in an inner city where there literally aren't any jobs, and also, like, how much power employers have. Is it easy for employers, as has increasingly been the case in the past 30 or 40 years in the U.S., for employers to break unions, right? Because that diminishes the power of workers in the labor market. And so I argue that the education myth has done a lot of damage, not because education's bad, but because it's allowed us as a political system to ignore all the other things that working people actually need to have economic security in the long term.
And you contrast this human capital notion with an idea represented by FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's, what he called the Second Bill of Rights, saying that people had rights to jobs that pay for their needs, health care, child care, the list goes on. Can you talk about that vision that, if I'm reading you right, got left behind by the education myth?
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to say something at the outset. It's really important that we don't romanticize some of the things that happened in the New Deal, as probably a lot of people know listening to this. But if you don't, I'll remind you, there were significant racial and gender inequalities woven into the New Deal because FDR and other Democrats had to accommodate white supremacist Democrats in the South who controlled a lot of congressional committees. So I don't want to romanticize this. But the key term here is social democracy, that coming out of the experience of the Great Depression and all of the efforts from working people across the United States, really since the beginning of the industrial era, to fight for labor rights and to fight for industrial democracy and to fight for health care and other things that people need to have good lives. The New Deal and the FDR administration really privileged the idea that of social democracy, expanding the economic and social rights of everyday Americans. And the political system completely changed under FDR, right? Democrats became the majority party in the United States for like 40 years until the 70s and 80s, arguably later than that. And they did that because they premised the entire political system on these economic and social rights for everyday workers. And they were deeply popular. So you have the expansion of retirement and Medicare and Medicaid in the 1960s, these deeply popular programs that made people's lives more economically secure. And that's really what the premise of the New Deal. And as you mentioned, the Economic Bill of Rights, which is a speech that really kind of capped the FDR administration in 1944 and its call for social democracy. And the argument that FDR made, and I think this will probably resonate with a lot of people today, is how can you be free if you can't find a good paying job? How can you be free if you don't have healthcare? How can you be free if you don't have the right to recreation and the right to transportation? And yes, education. How can you be free if you can't have all of those things? And so many of those things, they're massive impediments in a free market, supposed free market economy for people to access those things. And so what the New Deal was all about was actualizing those things so that people would have the economic security to have better lives. That's really what was driving it.
Talking to John Shelton from UW Green Bay about his new book, The Education Myth, How Human Capital Trumps Social Democracy. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. John, a big change here between that economic Bill of Rights idea and what you say is the human capital, the education myth is, okay, if we have a bunch of people in low-paying jobs, that other model, the FDR model, might be to say, okay, how do we get the wages for those jobs up so they're more livable? The human capital model seems to be, how can we get people education so they can get out of those low-paying jobs and into higher-paying jobs? How does that end up affecting people without college degrees, ultimately?
Yeah, and let me add one other thing to that, Rob, and this is important. Under the New Deal, it wouldn't just be let's try to raise people's wages. It would be let's directly create jobs so that workers have access to good paying jobs. Right. One of the big things about one of the most important successes of the New Deal was through the Works Progress Administration, literally creating millions of jobs that put people to work. So you get to the 1960s and Lyndon Johnson, and it's not just Johnson. There's many people around him, too. Are really concerned about the growing realizations of the poverty that still existed in the United States, even in this massively more prosperous time of the 1960s, right? There's all these exposés about poverty, and this connects to race, of course, because civil rights protesters are demanding economic equality. And so the Johnson administration is inspired to do something about this. And there's a debate in the administration, right, about how to solve this. Should there be more efforts to like literally create jobs in places like Detroit and Watts in Los Angeles, where African Americans have very limited economic opportunities? Or should the resources be given to try and expand education for people in those areas? And unfortunately, in my view, those resources go toward education as not that I think education is bad, again, but as the means to try and help them overcome their supposed deficiencies in the labor market, instead of ensuring that there are good jobs available for them. And that's a really, really important choice. And I think the Johnson administration did it for a couple of reasons. One, because you have economists and other people who had succeeded in the kind of academic meritocracy saying that was the best approach, right? Give people the right education. But it's also easier to do that, right? You don't have to upset the political assumptions and power dynamics that exist in society if you are just telling people we're going to give them education, right? And so, unfortunately, in my view, that then drives 50 years of policy in terms of how we're going to help people help people who have limited economic means, help them to gain better jobs and to gain economic security. And it's just impossible for that to work, right? And so when you hang everything on education, particularly, as you noted, the promise of college degrees, which becomes a much bigger part of this story, especially from the 90s on, when you have Clinton negotiating the North American Free Trade Agreement and saying we're going to reskill workers and pushing workers into college, and especially George W. Bush and Barack Obama pushing for college as the answer. What happens is you're telling all of those people, and in this country, something like 65% of Americans don't have college degrees. You're telling them, we don't have anything for you. So I argue that has led to, especially for folks without college degrees, a lot of disaffection with the political system, and has led to some of the really sort of intense cynicism, I think, toward politics in our political system.
We're talking to John Shelton, professor of democracy and justice studies at UW Green Bay. His new book is called The Education Myth, How Human Capital Trumps Social Democracy. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions, your questions for our guest. What is the purpose of education, of higher education? Should it be focused on job training and skills? Is that the best investment if we want to lift people out of poverty? Or do you like his notion of returning to FDR notions of social democracy? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with John Shelton, professor of democracy and justice studies at UW Green Bay. We're talking about his latest book. It's called The Education Myth, How Human Capital Trumped Social Democracy. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Laura is with us in Manitowoc. Laura, hi.
Hi. So I'm just calling really with my reaction, which is one of the things that you asked for. Thank you for taking my call. And I feel a little bit better after talking to the screener. She assured me that the guest is truly pro-academics or pro-education because, you know, at first listen, it doesn't really appear that way. It really sounds to me like what he's doing is advancing the kind of the fascist narrative that the right is really promulgating currently. I just hear them steadfastly being so pro-labor, not as we think of it in terms, you know, politically, but pro, I think, as opposed to pro-education. And I really feel that the purpose for, you know, getting an education is not to get a job. The purpose for getting an education is to get an education. So I agree with the guest on that account.
However, Laura, I gotcha. Thanks. You gave us a lot to talk about already there. John, a book called The Education Myth could be a very different book. And I think maybe that's what Laura was hearing off the bat.
Yeah. And trust me, this is not the first time I've gotten it. And Laura, appreciate you calling in and talking about that because it's a really important observation, a really important question. You know, I think one thing that might help is if you think about this in terms of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So for people listening to this, there's a psychologist named Abraham Maslow who talked about the things people needed to have good lives. And so if you think about it as a triangle, at the bottom is things like the again, like having basic needs met, right? Like things like shelter, food, housing, all of those things that we absolutely need as human beings just to kind of function. And so what I'm saying is what we've told people is, you don't get those things unless you figure out how to get the right skills through the education system, right? And what we need to do is guarantee all those things to people so that they have those basic things. And education should be something, absolutely, it's going to give you the skills to go and do different things. That's the whole that's one of the purposes of it. But it's also about training people in citizenship and training people how to you know, effectively be like, you know, humane people who can get along with each other and empower people to you know, have friendships and everything, you know, and all the things that we know make our lives good. But you can't require, you can't tie people's long-term economic security to whether or not they get the right education. And that's what I'm really saying here. I want everybody to have a good job, housing, healthcare, all those things, and the kind of education system that really enables people to be their best selves. That's really what I'm talking about. I am a deep believer in education. And what I'm saying is the way we save education is by making sure people have all these things. Save public education, I should say.
Laura, thanks for the call. And Laura also touches on, I think, a fundamental difference of opinion on the role of education. Education as preparing us for our jobs of the future versus education as preparing us to be citizens in a participatory democracy. Can you talk about that? Contrast.
That's absolutely right. And she mentioned, you know, kind of right wing politicians. I believe she used the term fascist. I won't use that, but right wing politicians and the way they're thinking about education. There's been a concerted effort. I'm a UW professor, right? Like I'm on the front lines of this. A concerted effort by the right in this country and in our state. That's why we got a budget cut in the UW system. To prevent us from talking about things that we know our students and the people of this state need to talk about, like race, gender, sexuality, and class. That's what this sort of effort that happened in the budget to deprive the UW system of funding to prevent us from being able to, you know, have resources for diversity, equity, and inclusion is really all about. So these are the fundamental stakes of this. Do we have an education system that is actually open to everyone and open to the pursuit of truth? Or do we have one which I think many people on the right would want that actually censors us and doesn't allow us to talk about the things that we know people need to learn about in order to have good lives? So she is onto something unbelievably important, and the stakes of that could not be higher.
Talking to John Shelton about his new book, The Education Myth, How Human Capital Trumped Social Democracy. John, you've got a vision for what you would hope education would look like and for public policy to look like. How do you see a way to get there from where we are now?
I think absolutely. And to go back to the point I was just making about the stakes of these debates around our education system, you're seeing people across the political spectrum have to really think about what it is we want our education system to do. And, you know, what I think, what we think about as Americans, most of us agree on is we want a democracy. Not only do we want a democracy, we want a multiracial democracy in which every person in this country is truly treated as an equal. And here's how we're going to get there. We're going to get there by making sure that every single person is treated with the dignity that they deserve, that they have access to economic security so that they can live lives without the fear of what's going to happen to them if they lose their job or somebody gets a health emergency. And the education system is going to help us get there, because what education can do at its best, public education, is teach people to be good citizens, empower them to challenge the world around them and to organize with all of the other people who they know in their neighborhood and at their workplace to build the kind of multiracial democracy that we all deserve in this country.
And John, some of your main, I think, criticism in the book is directed at Democratic leaders, as in the Democratic Party leaders over the decades, who embraced what you call the education myth and in some ways became a party of the educated and professionals, leaving, I think you make the case, working people behind, working people perceive the Democratic Party moving away from them. And you say they may have had good reason to feel that way.
I think that's absolutely right. And there's obviously a lot of examples I could use. I wrote a whole book about it. But maybe the quintessential example of this is Bill Clinton, who became president. He was the head of an organization called the Democratic Leadership Council, which was formed in the 1980s, essentially funded by donors, elite donors who wanted to move the Democratic Party away from its traditional focus on working people. And Clinton ran for presidency, of course, in 1992. And then when he became president, one of the first things he did was to extend George H.W. Bush's administration's negotiations for the North American Free Trade Agreement, which was incredibly controversial, NAFTA. Organized labor, environmentalists, all pushed to not have that law or to have that trade deal passed, because they knew it would cost lots of blue collar workers, people without college degrees, their jobs. And what the Clinton administration did is they basically, including Robert Reich, who's gone on to become a big progressive champion for working people since and said he was wrong about this, basically went around and said, it's okay, we know working people are going to lose their jobs, and that will lead to less economic security for them, but we're going to make it easier for them to retrain and they can go get another job. Well, not everybody wants to do that. People have pride in their jobs, right? And a lot of those people actually empirically didn't end up getting better jobs. They ended up with worse jobs and less secure jobs and jobs without unions. And so for a lot of working people, it didn't happen overnight, but you want to look at the kind of shift toward having at least some version, some amount of people without college degrees shifting away from the Democratic Party and going to the Republican Party over those next 20 years. That was a seminal moment. It was a very important moment. And it was, I think it was disastrous. I think it was a very bad policy choice and bad political choice for Democrats, frankly.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Anytime, Rob. Good luck with the rest of the show.
That's John Shelton, professor and chair of Democracy and Justice Studies at UW Green Bay, vice president for higher education for the American Federation of Teachers, Wisconsin. We've been talking about his latest book. It's called The Education Myth: How Human Capital Trumped Social Democracy. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, special effects, supervillains, and some politics. We'll hear from the authors of a new book about political and social issues on the big screen in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Plus, reserve a table for one. We'll get some encouragement to go out and do things on our own. Go solo, dinner at a restaurant, a movie, and more, and not feel weird doing it. That and more, it's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, here on the Ideas Network.